Okay, and welcome everyone to another Tuesday afternoon on Shake and Wake Radio. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this is Cancel the Cabal. I hope the volume levels are okay. Kind of backed off a little bit. Always seem to be quite loud whenever I'm with somebody else or whatever, but I don't want to get it up too high. But anyways, I am starting a new book today, The Scientific Outlook by Bertrand Russell. I guess I should. This is the second edition. Not sure. Okay, first edition published in 1931. That goes back a long ways. About 90 some odd years. 91, 92 years. Second edition, which is this one here, 2018. Not sure, but I don't think Bertrand Russell could have written this preparatory note to the second edition. But someone wrote, "In this edition, I have made no important changes, but have corrected topical allusions, which have become out of date. The material of the last few chapters may seem now more familiar than at the time of the first edition, since it has been popularized in two widely read books, Huxley's Brave New World and Burnham's Managerial Revolution. I do not suggest that this book had any influence on either of these, but the parallels are interesting and will, I hope, persuade the reader to my fears are more than an individual fantasy." Alrighty. Glad the levels are okay. The introduction. To say that we live in an age of science is a commonplace, but like most commonplaces, it is only partially true from the point of view of our predecessors. If they could view our society, we should no doubt appear to be very scientific. But from the point of view of our successors, it is probable that the exact opposite would seem to be the case. I guess just a note of my own. Bertrand Russell is one of the leaders of the think tanks. I don't remember which one now. I'm sure he's probably going to get into this, and maybe somebody can Google it before I get in much further. But he's one of the thinkers that the elites have used in the past, probably from the late 19th century on till his death. Whenever that was, I haven't Googled it. I should have gotten a little note about him, but I'm sure this is all going to be about, part one says examples of the scientific method. I think it's probably all going to be about their indoctrinating methods. Science as a factor in human life is exceedingly recent. Art was already well developed before the last glacial epoch. As we know from the admirable pictures in caves of the antiquity of religion, we cannot speak with equal confidence. But it is highly probable that it is coeval with art. At a guess, one might propose that both have existed for some 80,000 years. Science is an important force, begins with Galileo, and has therefore existed for some 300 years. During the first half of the short period, it remained a pursuit of the learned, which did not affect the thoughts or habits of ordinary men. It is only during the last 150 years that science has become an important factor in determining the everyday life of everyday people. In that short time, it has caused greater changes than had occurred since the days of ancient Egyptians. 150 years of science has proved more explosive than 5,000 years of pre-scientific culture. It would be absurd to suppose. And these pages are crisp and new, just like the last book, so they're going to be hard to turn sometimes. For me, anyways. It would be absurd to suppose that the explosive power of science is exhausted or has even reached its maximum. It is far from likely that science will continue for centuries to come to produce more and more rapid changes. One may suppose that a new equilibrium will ultimately be reached, either when so much is known that a lifetime is not sufficient to reach the frontiers of knowledge, and therefore further discovery must await some considerable increase of longevity, or when men become bored with the new toy, become wary of the strenuousness required in the making of scientific advances, and become content to enjoy the fruits of former labors, as the late Romans enjoyed the aqueducts built by their predecessors. Or again, it may prove that no scientific society is capable of stability, and that a revision of barbarism is a necessary condition of the continuance of human life. What does it say there, Annie? If you could read that out. Such speculations, however, though they may amuse an idle moment, are too nebulous to have any practical importance. What is important at the present time is that the influence of science upon our thoughts, our hopes, and our habits is continually increasing, and likely to increase for several centuries at least. Science, as its name implies, is primarily knowledge. By convention, it is knowledge of a certain kind, the kind, namely, which seeks general laws connecting a number of particular facts. Gradually, however, I have to stop and pontificate there. Whose facts? The truth or the indoctrinated facts? I guess we shall see. Gradually, however, the aspect of science as knowledge is being thrust into the background by the aspect of science as the power of manipulating nature. It is because science gives us the power of manipulating nature that it has more social importance than art. Science is the pursuit of truth, is the equal, but not the superior of art. Science as a technique, though it may have little intrinsic value, has a practical importance to which art cannot aspire. Science as a technique has a further consequence of which the implications are not yet fully evident, namely that it makes possible the even necessary new forms of human society. It has already profoundly modified the forms of economic organizations and functions of states. It is beginning to modify family life, and it almost certain to do so to as much greater extent in the not very distant future. And considering the effect of science upon human life, we have therefore three more or less separate matters to examine. First is the nature and scope of scientific knowledge. The second is the increased power of manipulation derived from scientific technique, and the third is the changes in social life and in traditional institutions which must result from the new forms of organization that scientific technique demands. Science as knowledge, of course, underlies the other two, since all the effects which science produces are the outcome of the knowledge which it provides. Man, hitherto, has been prevented from realizing his hopes by ignorance As this ignorance disappears, he becomes increasingly able to mold his physical environment. His social milieu and himself into the forms which he deems best, insofar as he is wise. This new power is beneficent. Beneficent. Never seen that word. Insofar as he is foolish, it is quite the reverse. If, therefore, a scientific civilization is to be a good civilization, it is necessary that increase in knowledge should be accompanied by increase in wisdom. I mean by wisdom a right conception of the ends of life. It is something which science in itself does not provide. Increase of science by itself, therefore, is not enough to guarantee any genuine progress. Though it provides one of the ingredients which progress requires. In the following pages, we shall be concerned with science rather than with wisdom. It is well to remember, however, that this preoccupation is one-sided and needs to be corrected if a balanced view of human life is to be achieved. Part 1. Scientific Knowledge. Chapter 1. Examples of Scientific Method. Galileo. Number 1. Scientific method, although in its more refined forms, it may seem complicated, is in essence remarkably simple. It consists in observing such facts as will enable the observer to discover general laws governing facts of the kind in question. The two stages, first of observation and the second of inference to a law, are both essential, and each is susceptible of almost indefinite refinement. But in essence, the first man who said fire burns was employing scientific method. At any rate, if he had allowed himself to be burnt several times, this man had already passed through the two stages of observation and generalization. He had not, however, what scientific technique demands, a careful choice of significant facts on the one hand, and on the other hand, various means of arriving at laws otherwise than by mere generalization. The man who says unsupported bodies in air fall has merely generalized and is liable to be refuted by balloons, butterflies, and aeroplanes. Whereas a man who understands the theory of falling bodies knows also why certain exceptional bodies do not fall. No, I'd never heard anybody say that, Keith, but welcome to chat here. I spoke to you in the other chat here just a few minutes ago. Scientific method, simple as it is in essence, has been acquired only with great difficulty and is still employed by a minority who themselves confine its employment to a minority of the questions upon which they have no opinions. If you number among your acquaintances some eminent man of science accustomed to the minutest quantitative precision in this, in his experiments, and the most abstruse skill in his inference. From them, you will be able to make him the subject of a little experiment, which is likely to be by no means unilluminating. If you tackle him on party politics, theology, income tax, house agents, and bumptiousness of the working classes and other topics of a like nature, you are pretty sure before long to provoke an explosion and to hear him expressing wholly untested opinions with a dogmatic which he would never display in regard to the well-founded results of his laboratory experiments. As this illusion shows, the scientific attitude is in some degree unnatural to man. The majority of our opinions are wish fulfillments, like dreams in a Freudian theory. The mind of the most rational among us may be compared to a stormy ocean of passionate convictions based upon desire, upon which float perilously in a few tiny boats carrying a cargo of scientifically tested beliefs. Nor is this to be altogether deplored. Life has to be lived, and there is no time to test rationally all the beliefs by which our conduct is regulated. Without a certain wholesome rashness, no one could long survive. Scientific method, therefore, must, in its very nature, be confined to the more solemn and official of our opinions. A medical man who gives advice on diet should give it after full consideration of all that science has to say on the matter. But the man who follows his advice cannot stop to verify it, and is obliged to rely, therefore, not upon science, but upon his belief that his medical advisor is scientific. A community impregnated with science is one in which the recognized experts have arrived at their opinions by scientific methods. But it is impossible for the ordinary citizen to repeat the work of the experts for himself. There is, in the modern world, a great body of well-attested knowledge on all kinds of subjects, which the ordinary man accepts on authority without any need for hesitation. But as that's the appeal to authority, logical fallacy right there. But as soon as any strong passion intervenes to warp the expert's judgment, he becomes unreliable. Whatever scientific equipment he may possess, the views of medical men on pregnancy, childbirth, and lactation were, until fairly recently, impregnated with sadism. It required, for example, more evidence to persuade them that anesthetics may be used in childbirth than it would have required to pursue them of the opposite. Anyone who desires an hour's amusement may be advised to look up the tergiversations of eminent craniologists in their attempts to prove that brain measurements, that women are stupider than men. I'm glad this was 1931, because he'd have been canceled in the cancel culture of today. It is not, however, the lapses of scientific men that concerns us. When we are trying to describe scientific method, A scientific opinion is one which there is some reason to believe true. An unscientific opinion is one which is held for some reason other than its probable truth. Our age of distinguishment, our age is distinguished from all ages before the 17th century by the fact that some of our opinions are scientific in the above sense. I accept bare matters of fact, since generality, in a greater or less degree, is an essential characteristic of science, and since men, with the exception of a few mystics, have never been able to wholly to deny the obvious facts in their everyday existence. The Greeks, eminent as they were in almost every department of human activity, did surprisingly little for the creation of science. The great intellectual achievement of the Greeks was geometry, which they believed to be an a priori study proceeding from self-evident premises and not requiring experimental verification. Well, the Greeks also did invent the system that is manipulating the world today. The rhetorical devices and the manipulations that are being used. They pretty much did invent that. The Greek genius was deductive rather than inductive, and was therefore at home in mathematics. In the ages that followed, Greek mathematics were nearly forgotten, while other products of the Greek passion for deduction survived and flourished, notably theology and law. The Greeks observed the world as poets rather than as men of scientific, partly, I think, because all manual activity was ungentlemanly, so that any study which required experiment seemed a little vulgar. Perhaps it would be fanciful to conduct with this prejudice the fact that the department in which the Greeks were most scientific was astronomy, which deals with bodies that can only be seen and not touched. However, it may be, it is certainly remarkable how much the Greeks discovered in astronomy. They early decided that the earth is round, and some of them arrived at the Copernican theory that it is the earth's rotation and not the revolution of the heavens that causes the apparent diurnal motion of the sun and stars. Archimedes, writing to King Galen of Syracuse, says, "Aristarchus of Samos brought out the book consisting of some hypotheses, of which the premises led to the conclusion that the universe is many times greater than that now so called. His hypotheses are that the fixed stars and the sun remain unmoved, that the earth revolves around the sun in the circumference of a circle, the sun lying in the center of the orbit. Thus the Greeks discovered not only the diurnal rotation of the earth, but also its annual revolution around the sun. It was the discovery of a Greek had held this opinion, which gave Copernicus courage to revive it. In the days of the Renaissance, when Copernicus lived, it was held that an opinion which had been entertained by the ancient might be true, but an opinion which no ancient had entertained could not deserve respect. I doubt whether Copernicus would have become a Copernican but for Aristarchus, whose opinion had been forgotten about until the revival of classic learning. I guess a good time to take the first break right here. And this is not a very, very long book either. It's probably only going to take about 6 or 7 weeks. So let me see. I guess about a 5-minute break here, everyone. So be right back in just a few.
He's more than a name.
Okay, welcome back after the first break there. I did forget, as I do occasionally, to say that all of the stations are listener-supported, so please help Andy out if you can. Any of the stations, SoFlo Radio, PSN Radio, EPGN Radio, and Shake and Wake. The Greeks also discovered perfectly valid methods of measuring the circumference of the Earth. Eratosthenes, the geographer, estimated it to be 250,000 stadia, about 24,662 miles, which is by no means far from the truth. The most scientific of the Greeks was Archimedes, 275 to 212 BC. Like Leonardo da Vinci in the later period, he recommended himself to a prince on the ground of his skill in the arts of war. And like Leonardo, he was granted permission to add to human knowledge on condition that he subtracted from human life. His activities and his respect were, however, more distinguished than those of Leonardo, since he invented the most amazing mechanical contrivances for defending the city of Syracuse against the Romans, and was finally killed by a Roman soldier when that city was captured. He is said to have been so absorbed in a mathematical problem that he did not notice the Romans coming. Plutarch is a very apologetic. Plutarch is very apologetic on the subject of the mechanical inventions of Archimedes, which he feels to have been hardly worthy of a gentleman, but he considers him excusable on the ground that he was helping his cousin, the king, at the time of dire peril. Archimedes showed what genius in mathematics and extraordinary skill in the invention of mechanical contrivances, but his contributions to science, remarkably as they are, still display the deductive attitude of the Greeks, which made the experimental method scarcely possible for them. His work on statistics is famous, and justly so, but it proceeds from axioms like Euclid's geometry, and the axioms are supposed to be self-evident, not the result of experiment. His book on floating bodies is the one which, according to tradition, resulted from the problem of King Hero's crown, which was suspected of being not made of pure gold. This problem, as everyone knows, Archimedes is supposed to have solved while in his bath. At any rate, the method which he proposes in his book for such cases is a perfectly valid one. And although the book proceeds from postulates by a method of deduction, one cannot but suppose that he arrived at the postulates experimentally. This is perhaps the most nearly scientific in the modern sense of the works of Archimedes. Soon after his time, however, such feelings as the Greeks had for the scientific investigation of natural phenomena decayed, and through pure luck, mathematics continued to flourish down to the capture of Alexandria by the Mohammedans. There were hardly any further advances in natural science, and the best that had been done, such as the theory of Aristarchus, I guess that's how you pronounce that name. The Arabs were more experimental than the Greeks, especially in chemistry. They hoped to transmute base metals into gold, to discover the Philosopher's Stone, and to concoct the elixir of life. Partly on this account, chemical investigations were viewed with favor. Through the Dark Ages, it was mainly by the Arabs that the tradition of civilization was carried on, and it was largely from them that Christians, such as Roger Bacon, acquired whatever scientific knowledge the later Middle Ages possessed. The Arabs, however, had a defect which was the opposite of the Greeks. They sought detached facts rather than general principles, and had not the power of inferring general laws from the facts which they discovered. In Europe, when the scholastic system first began to give way before the Renaissance, there came to be, for a time, a dislike of all generalizations and all systems. Montaigne illustrates this tendency. He likes queer facts, particularly if they disprove something. He has no desire to make his opinions systemic and coherent. Rabelais also, with his motto, not sure what, but this must be Greek. Fais ce que voudras. As an adverse from intellectual as from other fetters, the Renaissance rejoiced in the recovering liberty of speculation, and was not anxious to lose their liberty even in the interest of truth. Of the typical figures of the Renaissance, far to the most scientific was Leonardo, whose notebooks are fascinating and contain many brilliant anticipations of later discoveries. But he brought almost nothing of fruition, and remained without effect upon his scientific successors. Scientific method, as we understand it, comes unto the world full-fledged with Galileo, 1564 to 1642, and as to somewhat lesser degree, in his contemporary, Kepler, 1571-1630. Kepler is known to fame through his three laws. He first discovered that the planets were round the sun in ellipses, not in circles. To the modern mind, there is nothing astonishing in the fact that the Earth's orbit is an ellipse. But to minds trained on antiquity, anything except a circle, or some complication of circles, seemed almost incredible for a heavenly body. To the Greeks, the planets were divine, and most therefore move in perfect curves. Circles and ellipses do not offend their aesthetic susceptibilities. But a crooked, skew orbit, such as the Earth's actually is, would have shocked them deeply. Unprejudiced observation without regard to aesthetic prejudices required, therefore, at that time, a rare intensity of scientific ardor. It was Kepler and Galileo who estimated the fact that the Earth and the other planets go around the sun. This had been asserted by Copernicus and, as we have seen, by certain Greeks, but they had not succeeded in giving proofs. Copernicus, indeed, had no serious arguments to advance in favor of his view. It would be doing Kepler more than justice to suggest that in adopting the Copernican hypothesis, he was acting on purely scientific motives. It appears that, at any rate, in youth, he was addicted to sun worship and thought the center of the universe the only place worthy of so great a deity. None but scientific motives, however, could have led him to the discovery of the planetary orbits or ellipses and not circles. He, and still more Galileo, possessed the scientific method in its completeness. While much more is known than was known in their day, nothing essential has been added to method. They proceeded from observation to particular facts to the establishment of exact quantitative laws, by means of which future particular facts could be predicted. They shocked their contemporaries profoundly, partly because their conclusions were inherently shocking to the beliefs of the age, but partly also because the belief in authority had enabled learned men to confide their researches to libraries, and the professors were pained at the suggestion it might be necessary to look at the world in order to know what it is like. Galileo, it must be confessed, was something of a gamin. When still very young, he became professor of mathematics at Pisa. But as the salary was only 7.5 denarii, is that what that is, maybe? 7.5 denarii a day, he does not seem to have thought that a very dignified bearing could be expected of him. He began writing a treatise against the wearing of cap and gown at the university, which may perhaps be more popular with undergraduates, but was viewed as grave disfavor by his fellow professors. He would amuse himself by arranging occasions which would make his colleagues look silly. They asserted, for example, on the basis of Aristotle's physics, and the body weighing 10 pounds would fall through a given distance in 1/10 of the time that would be taken by a body weighing 1 pound. So he went up to the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa one morning with a 10-pound shot and a 1-pound shot, and just as the professors were proceeding with leisurely dignity to their respective lecture rooms in the presence of their pupils, he attracted their attention and dropped the 2 weights from the top of the tower to their feet. The 2 weights arrived practically simultaneously. The professors, however, maintained that their eyes must have deceived them, since it was impossible that Aristotle could be in error. Maybe that's why the tower leans today. He took too much weight to the one side. I don't know. On another occasion, he was even more rash. Giovanni de Medici, who was the governor of Leghorn, invented a dredging machine in which he was very proud. Galileo pointed out that whatever else it might do, it would not dredge, which proved to be a fact. This caused Giovanni to become an ardent Aristotelian. Galileo became unpopular and was hissed at his lectures, a fate which also befell Einstein in Berlin. Then he made a telescope and invited the professors to look through it at Jupiter's moons. They refused on the ground that Aristotle had not mentioned these satellites, and therefore anybody who thought he saw them must be mistaken. The experiment from the Leaning Tower of Pisa illustrated Galileo's first important piece of work. namely the establishment of the law of falling bodies, according to which all bodies fall at the same rate in a vacuum, and at the end of a given time have a velocity proportional to the time in. Which they had been falling, and have traversed a distance proportional to the square of that time. Aristotle had maintained otherwise, but never he nor any of his successors throughout nearly 2,000 years had taken the trouble to find out whether he said was true, whether what he said was true. The idea of doing so was a novelty. And Galileo's disrespect for authority was considered abominable. He had, of course, many friends, men to whom the spectacle of intelligence was delightful in itself. Few such men, however, held academic posts, and university opinion was bitterly hostile to his discoveries. Here comes a logical fallacy. Right as the very first three words. As everybody knows, he came in conflict with the Inquisition at the end of his life for maintaining that the earth goes around the sun. He had had a previous minor encounter from which he had emerged without great damage. But in the year 1632, he published a book of dialogues on the Copernican and the Ptolemaic systems, in which he had the temerity to place some remarks that had been made by the Pope into the mouth of the character named Simplicius. The Pope had hitherto been friendly to him, but at this point became furious. Galileo was living at Florence on the terms of friendship with the Grand Duke, but the Inquisition sent for him to come to Rome to be tried, and threatened the Grand Duke with pains and penalties if he continued to shelter Galileo. Galileo was at the time 70 years old, very ill, and going blind. He sent a medical certificate to the effect that he was not fit to travel. So the Inquisition sent a doctor of their own with orders that as soon as he was well enough, he should be brought in chains. Upon hearing that this order was on its way, he set out voluntarily. By means of threats, he was induced to make submission. The sentence of the Inquisition is an interesting document. Whereas you, Galileo, son of the late Vincenzo Galilei of Florence, aged 70 years, were denounced in 1615 to his holy office for holding as true a false doctrine taught by many, namely the sun is immovable in the center of the world, and that the earth moves, and also with a diurnal motion, also having pupils whom you instructed in the same opinions, also for maintaining a correspondence on the same with some German mathematicians, also for publishing certain letters on the sunspots, in which you developed the same doctrine as true. Also for answering the objections which were continually produced from the Holy Scriptures. By closing the said Scriptures according to your own meaning, and whereas thereupon were produced a copy of the writing, in form of a letter profusely written, professedly written by you to a person firmly your pupil, in which, following the hypothesis of Copernicus, you included several proportions contrary to the true sense and authority of the Holy Scriptures. Therefore, this holy tribunal, being desirous of providing against the disorder and mischief which were thence proceeding, and increasing the detriment of the holy faith, by the desire of the holiness and of the most eminent lords cardinals of his supreme and the universal inquisition, the two propositions of the stability of the sun and the motion of the earth were qualified by the theological qualifiers as follows. 1. The proposition that the sun is in the center of the world and immovable from its place is absurd, philosophically false, and formally heretical, because it is expressly contrary to the Holy Scriptures. 2. The proposition that the earth is not the center of the world, nor immovable, but that it moves and also has a diurnal action, is also absurd, philosophically false, and theologically considered at least erroneous in faith. But whereas, being pleased at that time to deal mightily with you, it was decreed in the Holy Congregation, held before His Holiness on the 25th day of February, 1616, that His Eminence, the Lord Cardinal Bellarmine, should enjoin you to give up altogether the said false doctrine, and if you should refuse, that you should be ordered to the commissary of the Holy Office to relinquish it, not to teach it to others, nor to defend it, and in default of acquiescence, that you should be imprisoned. And whereas, in execution of this decree, on the following day, at the palace, in the presence of the Eminence, the said Lord Cardinal Bellarmine, after you had been mildly admonished by the said Lord Cardinal, you are commanded by the commissary of the Holy Office, before a notary and witnesses, to relinquish altogether the said false opinion, and in future neither to defend nor teach it in any manner, neither verbally nor in written, and upon your promising obedience, you were dismissed. Yeah, I'm going to find a pen and mark my spot and take the second break here. And at the perfect time, too. I needed something to drink, so let me see here. I guess, I don't know, about a 5-minute break. 4:45. Be right back, everyone.
Gore and I wrote this back in 1963. Back when your mom and daddy were just courting, right?
Just courting.
Yeah.
watch me sin. Oh, he touched me. Let me hear you sing it. Oh, the joy. Oh, the joy. Something happened.
Something happened.
He touched me.
Okay, we're back for the second hour. And in order, this is still going on with the Inquisition's note. Seems to be quite a few pages. And in order that so pernicious of a doctrine might be altogether rooted out, not insinuate itself further to the heavy detriment of the Catholic truth. A decree emanated from the Holy Congregation of the Index prohibiting the books which treat of this doctrine, declaring it false and altogether contrary to the holy and divine scripture. And whereas a book has since appeared published at Florence last year, the title of which showed that you were the author, which title is the Dialogue of Galileo Galilei on the two principal systems of the world, the Plutimac. I don't know how that word is. I guess the P is silent. The Ptolemaic. And Copernican. And whereas the Holy Congregation has heard that, in consequence of printing the said book, the false opinion of the earth's motion and stability of the sun is daily gaining ground. The said book has been taken into careful consideration, and in it has been detected a glaring violation of the said order, which had been intimated to you, inasmuch as in this book you have defended the said opinion already, and in your presence condemned, although in the same book you labor with many circumlocutions to induce the belief that it is left undecided and merely probable, which is equally a very grave error, since an opinion can in no way be probable which has already declared and finally determined contrary to the divine scripture. Therefore, by our order, you have been cited in this holy office, where on your examination upon oath you have acknowledged that the said book as written and printed by you. You also confessed that you began to write the said book 10 or 12 years ago, after the order aforesaid had been given. Also, that you had demanded license to publish it without signifying to those who granted you this permission that you had been commanded not to hold, defend, or teach the said doctrine in any manner. You also confessed that the reader might think the arguments adduced on a false side to be so worded as more effectually to compel conviction than to be easily refutable, alleging in accused that you had thus ran into an error, foreign, as you say, to your intention for writing in the form of a dialogue, and in consequence of the natural complacency which everyone feels with regard to his own subtleties, and in showing himself more skillful than the generality of mankind in contriving, even in favor of false propositions, ingenious and plausible arguments. Yeah. Oh no, Annie. And upon the convenient time being given you were for making your defense, you produced a certificate in the handwriting of His Eminence the Lord Cardinal Bellarmine, procured, as you said, by yourself, that you might defend yourself against the calumnies of your enemies, who reported that you had abjured your opinions, and had been published by the Holy Office, in which certificate it is declared that you had not abjured nor had been published, had been punished, but merely that the declaration made by His Holiness and promulgated by the Holy Congregation of the Index had been announced to you, which declares that the opinion of the motion of the earth and the stability of the sun is contrary to the Holy Scriptures, and therefore cannot be held or defended. Wherefore, since no mention is there made of two articles of the order, to wit, the order not to teach, and in any manner, you argue that we ought to believe that in the lapse of 14 or 16 years you had escaped from that, had escaped your memory, and that this was also the reason why you were silent as to the order when you sought permission to publish your good grief, this thing just goes on and on. This letter, your book, and this is said by you, not to excuse your error, but it may be attributed to vain, glorious ambition, rather than to malice. But this very certificate produced on your behalf has greatly aggravated your offense, since it is therein declared that the said opinion is contrary to the Holy Scriptures, and yet you have dared to treat of it, and to argue that it is probable. Nor is there any extenuation to the license artfully and cunningly extorted by you, since you did not intimate the command imposed upon you. But whereas it appeared to us that you had not disclosed the whole truth with regard to your intention, we thought it necessary to proceed to the rigorous examination of you, in which, without any prejudice to what you had confessed, and which is above detailed against you with regard to your said intention. You answered like a good Catholic. Therefore, having seen and maturely considered the merits of your cause, with your said confessions and excuses, and everything else which ought to be seen and considered, we have come to the underwritten final sentence against you. Therefore, having seen and maturely, invoking therefore the most holy name of our Lord Jesus Christ and of his most glorious Virgin Mother Mary, we pronounce this our final sentence, which, sitting in council and judgment of the reverend masters of sacred theology and doctors of both law, our assessors, we put forth in this writing in regard to the matters and controversies between the magnificent Carlo Cincerio, doctor of both laws, fiscal proctor of the Holy Office, of the one part, and you, Galileo Galilei, defendant, tried and confessed as above, of the order part. We pronounce judge and declare that you, the said Galileo, by reason of these things, which have been detailed in the course of this writing, and which as above you have confessed, have rendered yourself vehemently suspected by this holy office of heresy, that is, of having believed and held the doctrine which is false and contrary of a holy divine scriptures, that the sun is the center of the world, and that it does not move from east to west, and that the earth does move and is not the center of the world. Also, that an opinion can be held and supported and probable that it has been declared and finally decreed contrary of the Holy Scripture, and consequently that you have incurred all of the censures and penalties enjoined and promulgated in the sacred canons and other general and particular constitutions against delinquents of this description, from which it is our pleasure that you be absolved, provided with a sincere heart and unfeigned faith in our presence. You abjure, curse, and detest the said errors and heresies, another error and heresy contrary to the Catholic and Apostolic Church of Rome, in the form now shown to you. But your grievous and promiscuous error and transgressed may not go altogether unpunished, that you may be made more cautious in future, and may be a warning to others to abstain from delinquencies of this sort. We decree that the book Dialogues of Galileo Galilei be prohibited by the public edict, and we condemn you to the formal prison of his holy office for a period determinable at our pleasure, and by way of salutary penance, we order you during the next 3 years to recite once a week the 7 penitential psalms, reserving to ourselves the power of moderating, commuting, or taking off the whole part of the said punishment or penance. Okay, here is the formula of abjuration, which, as a consequence of this sentence, Galileo was compelled to pronounce, was as follows. Number 1, Galileo Galilei, son of the late Valencio Galilei of Florence, aged 70 years, being brought personally to judgment and kneeling before you, most eminent and most reverend lords, cardinals, general inquisitors of the universal Christian Republic against heretical depravity. Having before my eyes the holy gospels, which I touch with my own hands, swear that I have always believed, and with the help of God will in the future believe, every article which the Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church of Rome holds, teaches, and preaches. But because I have been enjoined by this holy office, all together and abundant the false opinion which maintains that the sun is the center and immovable. Lost my place. Went to scratch my nose and I lost my place. I have always believed that, with the help of God, will in the future believe every article which the Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church of Rome holds, teaches, and preaches. But because I have been enjoined by this holy office altogether and abundant the false opinion, which maintains that the sun is the center and immovable, and forbidden to hold, defend, or teach the said false doctrine in any manner, and becoming after it, had been signified to me that the said doctrine is repugnant. To the Holy Scripture, I have written and printed a book in which I treat of the same condemned doctrine and adduce reasons with great force in support of the same, without giving any solution, and therefore have been judged grievously suspected of heresy. That is to say that I held and believed that the sun is the center of the world and immovable, and that the earth is not the center of a center and movable. I am willing to remove from the minds of your eminences and of every Catholic Christian this vehement suspicion rightly entertained towards me. Therefore, with the sincere heart and unfeigned faith, I adjure, curse, and detest the said errors and heresies, and generally every other error and sect contrary to the said Holy Church. And I swear that I will never more in future say or assert anything, verbally or in writing, which may give rise to a similar suspicion of me. But that if I shall know any heretic or anyone suspected of heresy, I will denounce him to this holy office, or to the inquisitor and the ordinary of the place in which I may be. I swear, moreover, and promise that I will fulfill and observe fully all the penances which I have been or shall be laid on me by this holy office. But if it shall happen that I violate any of my said promises, oaths, or protestations, which God avert, I subject myself to all the pains and punishments which have been decreed and promulgated by the sacred canons and other general particular constitutions against delinquents of this description. So may God help me and his holy gospels, which I touch with my own hands. I, the above named Galileo Galilei, have adjourned, sworn, promised, and bound myself as above, and witness thereof with my own hand, have subscribed this present writing of my abjuration, which I recited word for word. At Rome in the convent of Minerva, June 22, 1633, I, Galileo Galilei, have adjourned as above with my own hand. It is not true that after reciting this abjuration, he muttered, "A poor C. Morove," which, I'm sorry, it was the world that said this, not Galileo. It doesn't explain what that means. The Inquisition stated that Galileo's fate should be a warning to others to abstain from delinquencies of this sort. And this, they were successful so far, at least as Italy was concerned. Galileo was the last of the great Italians. No Italian since his day has been capable of delinquencies of this sort. It cannot be said that the Church has altered greatly since the time of Galileo. However, it has power, as in Ireland and Boston, it still forbids all literature containing new ideas. The conflict between Galileo and the Inquisition is not merely the conflict between free thought and bigotry, or between science and religion. It is a conflict between the spirit of induction and the spirit of deduction. Those who believe in deduction as the method of arriving at knowledge are compelled to find these premises somewhere, usually in a sacred book. Deduction from inspired books, as in the method of arriving at truth employed by jurists, Christians, Mohammedans, and communists. Since deduction also means of obtaining knowledge collapses when doubt is thrown upon its premises. Those who believe in deduction must necessarily be bitter against men who question the authority of the sacred books. Galileo questioned both Aristotle and the scriptures, and thereby destroyed the whole edifice of medieval knowledge. His predecessors had known the world was created. That was man's destiny. The deepest mysteries of metaphysics and the hidden principles governing the behavior of bodies. Throughout the moral and material universe, nothing was mysterious to them, nothing hidden, nothing incapable of exposition of orderly or of orderly syllogisms. Compared with all this wealth, what was left to the followers of Galileo? A law of falling bodies, the theory of the pendulum, and Kepler's ellipses. Can it be wondered at that the learned cried out as such a destruction of their hard-won wealth? As the rising sun scatters the multitude of stars, so Galileo's few proved truth banished the scintillating firmament of medieval certainties. Socrates had said that he was wiser than his contemporaries because he alone knew that he knew nothing. This was a rhetorical device. Galileo could have said with truth that he knew something, but knew he knew little. While his Aristotelian contemporaries knew nothing, but thought they knew much, knowledge is opposed to fantasies of wish fulfillment is difficult to come by. A little contract with real knowledge makes fantasies less acceptable. As a matter of fact, knowledge is even harder to come by than Galileo supposed, and much he believed was only approximate. But in the process of acquiring knowledge at one secure and general, Galileo took the great step. He is, therefore, the father of modern times. Whatever he may like or dislike about the age in which we live, its increase of population, its improvement in health, really, its trains, motor cars, radios, politics, and advertisements of soap, all emanate from Galileo. If the Inquisition could have caught him young, he might not now be enjoying the blessings of air wherefore and atomic bombs, nor, on the other hand, the diminution of poverty and disease, which is a characteristic of our age. It is a customary amongst a certain school of sociologists to minimize the importance of intelligence and to attribute all great events to large impersonal causes. I believe this to be an entire delusion. I believe that if 100 of the men of the 17th century had been killed in infancy, the modern world would not exist. And of these 100, Galileo is the chief. Perfect time for another break. Need to get my need to get another drink. I guess about 2 short songs. Gonna be close to 5 minutes, everyone, so be right back.
Okay, let's see how long my voice can hold up for the last 20 minutes or so. I'm betting not very long. Yeah, I'm getting thirsty. Quite a bit today. Bet my sugar levels are through the roof. Part 2, or number 2, Newton. Sir Isaac Newton was born in the year in which Galileo died, 1642. Like Galileo, he lived to be a very old man, as he died in the year 1727. In the short period between these two men's activities, the proposition of science in the world was completely changed. Galileo, all his life, had to fight against the recognized men of learning, and in his last years had to suffer persecution and condemnation of his work. Newton, on the other hand, from the moment when, at the age of 18, he became an undergraduate at Trinity College, Cambridge, received universal applause. Less than 2 years after he had taken his MA degree, the masters of his college was describing him as the man of incredible genius. Well, thanks, Mom. And, that must be Sarah. No. Not sure who 6441 is. He was acclaimed by the whole learned world. He was honored by monarchs, and in the true English spirit, was rewarded for his work by the government post in which he could not be continued. So important was he that when George the First ascended to the throne, the great Leibniz had to be left behind at Hanover because he and Newton had quarreled. It is fortunate for succeeding ages that Newton's circumstances were so placid. He was a timorous, nervous man, at once quarrelsome and afraid of controversy. He hated publication because it exposed him to criticism. And he had to be bullied into publishing by kind friends. A propose of his optics, he wrote to Leibniz, I was so persecuted with discussions arising from the publication of my theory of light that I blamed my own imprudence for parting with so substantial a blessing as my quiet to run after a shadow. If he had encountered the sort of opposition with which Galileo had to contend, it is probable that he would never have published a line. Newton's triumph was the most spectacular. Newton's triumph was the most spectacular in the history of science, astronomy, since the time of the Greeks, had been at once the most advanced and the most respected of the sciences. Kepler's laws were still fairly recent, and the third of them was by no means universally accepted. Moreover, they appeared strange and unaccountable to those who had been accustomed to circles and epicycles. Galileo's theory of the tides was not right, and the motions of the moon were not properly understood, and astronomers could not but feel the loss of that epic unity that the heavens possessed. In the Ptolemaic system, Newton, at one stroke by his law of gravity, brought order and unity into this confusion. Not only the major aspects of the motions of the planets and satellites were accounted for, but also all the niceties at that time known. Even the comets, which not so long ago had blazed forth the death of princes, were found to proceed according to the law of gravitation. Halley's Comet was one of the most obliging among them, and Halley was Newton's best friend. Newton's Principia proceeds in the grand Greek manner. From the three laws of motion and the law of gravitation, by purely mathematical deduction, the whole solar system is explained. Newton's work is statuesque and Hellenic, unlike the most work of our own time. The nearest approach to the same classical perfection among moderns is the theory of relativity, and even that does not aim at the same finality, since the rate of progress nowadays is too great. Everyone, another logical fallacy, everyone knows the story of the fall of the apple, yes. Unlike most such stories, it is not certainly known to be false. At any rate, it was in the year 1665 that Newton first thought of the law of gravitation, and in that year an account of the Great Plague. He spent his time in the country, possibly in an orchard. He did not publish his Principia until the year 1687. For 21 years he was content to think over his theory and gradually perfect it. No modern would dare do such a thing, since 21 years is enough to change completely the scientific landscape. Even Einstein's work was always contained ragged edges, unsolved doubts, and unfinished speculations. I do not say that this is a criticism. I say it as only to illustrate the difference between our age and that age of Newton. We aim no longer at perfection because of the army of successors whom we can scarcely outstrip and who are at every moment ready to obliterate our traces. The universe respect, according to Newton, as contrasted in the treatment meted out of Galileo, and was due in the part of Galileo's own work, and to that of the other men of sciences who fulfilled the intervening years. But it was due also, and quite as much, to the course of politics. In Germany, the Thirty Years' War, which was raging when Galileo died, halved the population without achieving the slightest change in the balance of power between Protestants and Catholics. This caused even the least reflective to think that perhaps wars of religion were a mistake. France, though a Catholic power, had supported the German Protestants, and Henry IV, although he became a Catholic in order to win Paris, was not led by this motive into any great bigotry with regard to his new faith. In England, the Civil War, which began in the year of Newton's birth, led to the rules of the saints, which turned everybody except the saints against religious zeal. Newton entered the university of the year after that in which Charles II returned from exile, and Charles II, who founded the Royal Society, did all in his power to encourage science. Partly, no doubt, as an anecdote to bigotry, Protestant bigotry had kept him in exile, while Catholic bigotry caused his brother to lose the throne. Charles II, who was an intelligent monarch, made it a rule of government to avoid having to set out on his travels again. The period from his accession to his death of Queen Anne was the most brilliant intellectually in English history. In France, meanwhile, Descartes had inaugurated modern philosophy, but his theory of vortices proved an obstacle to the acceptance of Newton's ideas. It was only after Newton's death, and largely as a result of Voltaire's Lettres Philosophiques, that Newton gained vogue. But when he did, his vogue was terrific. In fact, throughout the following century, down to the fall of Napoleon, it was chiefly the French who carried on Newton's work. The English were misled by patriotism into adhering to his methods, where they were inferior to those of Leibniz. With the result, after his death, English mathematics were negligible for 100 years. The harm that in Italy was done by bigotry was done in England by nationalism. It would be hard to say which of these two proved the more pernicious. Though Newton's Principia retains the deductive form, which was inaugurated by the Greeks, its spirit is quite different from that of Greek work. Since the law of gravitation, which is one of its premises, is not supposed to be self-evident, but is arrived at the inductively from Kepler's laws. The book therefore illustrates scientific method in the form which in its ideal, from observation of particular facts, it arrives as induction at a general law, and by deduction from a general law, other particular facts are inferred. This is still the ideal of physics, which is the science from which, in theory, all others ought to be deduced. But the realism of the ideal is somewhat more difficult than it seemed in Newton's day. The premature systemization has been found to be a danger. Newton's law of gravitation has had a peculiar history. Well, it continued for over 200 years to explain almost every fact that was known in regard to the motions of the heavenly bodies. It remained in itself isolated and mysterious among natural laws. New branches of physics grew to vast proportions. The theories of sound, heat, light, and electricity were successfully explored. But no property of matter was discovered which could be in any way connected with gravitation. It was only through Einstein's general theory of relativity, 1915, that gravitation was fitted into the general scheme of physics. And then it was found to belong rather to geometry than to physics in the old-fashioned sense. From a practical point of view, Einstein's theory involves only very minute corrections of Newtonian results. Their very minute corrections, so far as they are measurable, have been empirically verified. But while the practical change is small, the intellectual change is enormous. since our whole conception of space and time has had to be revolutionized. The work of Einstein was emphasized, the difficulty of permanent achievement in science. Newton's law of gravitation had reigned so long and explained so much that it seemed scarcely credible that it should stand in need of correction. Nevertheless, such correction has at last proved necessary, and no one doubts that the correction will, in its turn, have to be corrected. Number 3, Darwin. The earliest triumphs of scientific method were in astronomy. Its most noteworthy triumphs in quite recent times have been in atomic physics. Both these are matters requiring such mathematics for their treatment. Perhaps it is in its ultimate perfection all science will be mathematical. But in the meantime, there are vast fields in which mathematics is scarcely applicable. And among these are to be found some of the most important achievements of modern science. We may take Darwin's work as illustrative of the non-mathematical sciences. Darwin, like Newton, dominated the intellectual outlook of an epoch, not only men of science, but among the general educated public, and like Galileo, he came into the conflict with theology, through with results less. Disastrous to himself. Darwin's importance to the history of culture is very great, but the value of his work from a strictly scientific point of view is difficult to appraise. He did not invent the hypothesis of evolution, which had occurred to many of his predecessors. He brought a mass of evidence in his favor, and he invented a certain mechanism which he called natural selection. To account for it, much of his evidence remains valid. Yeah, that's up for debate. But natural selection is less in favor amongst biologists than it used to be. He was a man who traveled widely, observed intellectually, and reflected patiently. Few men in his eminence have had less of the quality called brilliance. No one thought much of him in his youth. At Cambridge, he was content to do no work and take a pass degree. Not being able at the time to study biology in the university, he preferred to spend his time walking around the country collecting beetles, which was officially a form of idleness. His real education he owed to the voyage of the Beagle, which gave him the opportunity of studying the flora and the fauna of many regions, and of observing the habitats of allied but geographically separated species. Some of his best work was concerned with what is now called ecology, i.e. the geographical distribution of species and genera. He observed, for example, that the vegetation of the high Alps resembled that of the polar regions, from which he inferred a common ancestry at the time of the glacial epoch. Apart from scientific details, Darwin's importance lies in the fact that he caused biologists and, through them, the general public to abandon the former belief of the immutability of species and to accept a view of that all different kinds of animals have developed by variation out of a common ancestry. Like every other innovator of modern times, he had to combat the authority of Aristotle. Aristotle, it should be said, has been one of the great misfortunes of the human race. To this day, the teaching of logic in most universities is full of nonsense, for which he is responsible. Really, the teaching of logic is full of nonsense. Wow. The theory of I don't really know what to say to that. 1931, the beginning of the dumbing down of America. Trust your doctor. Trust your scientist. Trust your lawyer. Trust your judge. Trust your politician. No matter what. No matter what. The theory of biologists before Darwin was the there is laid up in heaven an ideal cat and an ideal dog, and so on, and that actual cats and dogs are more or less imperfect copies of these celestial types. Each species corresponds to a different idea in the divine mind, and therefore there could be no transition from one species to another, since each species resulted from a separate act of creation. Geological evidence made this view increasingly difficult to maintain, since the ancestors of existing widely separated types were found to resemble each other much more closely than to the species of the present day. The horse, for example, once had his proper complement of toes. Early birds were scarcely distinguishable from reptiles, and so on, while the particular mechanism of natural selection is longer regarded by biologists as adequate. The general fact of evolution is now universally admitted among educated people. Well, gonna stop right here for the day, mark my spot. So I don't forget. I guess. I'm going to play my intro again just at the end. Just because it's only 2 minutes long. So, say thanks everyone for coming out. And see everyone tomorrow for me and Roger.